Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, those of us who attended the Duke-Carolina basketball game, some of us were disappointed in the result of the game, but all of us had the opportunity to watch an amazing presentation at halftime. And I'll just tell you that I was floored by the presentation by students of a $250,000 check to an organization that I've learned a lot about in the course of the presentation and some of the events that have happened as a part of it. And so I wanted to find out more. And luckily, I've got the top dog here from New York, who's in charge of the executive branch of the Millennium Villages Project. And that's Jeff Flug, and Jeff has been down here to participate in that award. And Jeff, thanks for bringing with you one of the student leaders, Nathan Sikar, who's a Carolina senior and is one of the leaders of the Millennium Village Project on campus. All right, now, all of that having been done, you're a businessman who got converted into the anti-poverty business. And what I want you to do, if you will, is to start out by telling us what you were doing down here in Chapel Hill these past few days.
Sure. First of all, DJ, it's terrific to be here. And just for the record, I was actually rooting for a tie last night. it is terrific to be here. The reason I was down here last night was because a few exceptional leaders, both business community leaders and student leaders, decided they wanted to get involved and put their imprint on ending extreme poverty. And just by definition, extreme poverty is defined as those people trying to survive on under $1 a day. And the latest statistics in our world, there are about 1.1 billion people living on under a dollar, trying
out
to
of,
live.
4 or 5 billion.
At about 6.5 on under
20%.
And that doesn't take into account another 1.5 billion people who live on between $1 and $2 a day. So if you do that math, you're close to 40% of the world's population is surviving or trying to survive on under $2 a day. And why we're here is because the students at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Bennett College, and Duke University, they said that's an unacceptable number. The business people in this community and some of the community leaders said that's unacceptable, and we want to get behind something to make a difference in that.
Well, I mean, it's just an enormous problem. So how do you develop something that a group of kids on a college campus can do to make any kind of significant difference?
You got to start somewhere. And the Millennium Village Project, which was created 4 or 5 years ago by really inspired and architected by Dr. Jeffrey Sachs, the professor at Columbia University, and working in conjunction with the United Nations, came up with a model called the Millennium Village Model. And the model was really designed to bring holistic, comprehensive solutions to places that are just cut off from any of this technology or scientific advancement. So in areas of agriculture, in water management, in healthcare, in education, and came up with a framework to deliver these in a holistic integrated package. And what the students did here at the University of North Carolina and Duke and Bennett College, they said, we want to fund that intervention work. And we're going to fund it for 5 years, which is the model's length, for 5 years. And they got behind, and they brought in the business leadership in the local area to financially make it feasible. And they're also out raising money. And more than just money, they're giving their time and efforts into raising the awareness and advocacy of how we all can make a difference in ending extreme poverty.
Jeff, I'm real curious about the particular, I think that there's a particular village that these kids are working on, and Nathan Sikar is here.
Yes.
I'd like for one of you to tell me about this village that the kids are the young, I'm sorry, Nathan, not the kids, the young men and women are focusing on. Can you tell us about that village?
Sure. Our partner community's name is Marenyo, Kenya. It's located in southwest Kenya near Lake Victoria. And the way MVP is set up is that it's working in all of Africa's 12 different agroecological zones to prove that no matter what the different agricultural or ecological or geographic conditions, extreme poverty can be surmounted. And this is in a dry zone in southwestern Kenya. The main central village community that Millennium Promise has been working with is Sari, Kenya. And if you can look that up on the web, you'll find all sorts of information about Sari.
How many people? What is the village like?
Sure. Well, a community is, for the purpose of the project, is defined about 5,000 people. So the village of Moreno is really a cluster of communities that contains about 5,000 people.
And what about this? And is there? I'm a little bit confused. But what is the village that you guys or the community that Carolina, Duke, and Bennett are focused on?
I'd say our partner community is Moreno, and Moreno is close to Sari, which is another Millennium Village. But the reason I mentioned Sari is because it's more prominent in the news.
But Moreno, how many people are in this village?
So there are 5,000 people in the community of Moreno, and there are another 5,000 people in Sari.
Gotcha. All right, so these are two equal villages as far as the Millennium Project is concerned.
Absolutely.
All right, now what I want you to do is to tell me, what is a village like? And I'll tell you, I've got an idea about what a North Carolina village is, and I've got an idea about how it's governed and about the, the churches and the general stores and the surroundings. But you say village and transport me to Kenya. Help me understand what a village is like there.
So if you go into a village in rural Africa, you're not going to find any plumbing. You're not going to find any electricity. You're not going to the structures that you might see you might see a primary school defined by grades 1 through 8. And that will be a thatched roof, dirt floor, hardly any desks, and a makeshift blackboard. You're not going to find any health facility, and absolutely no roads or infrastructure in the community. The people living there will be, if they're lucky, in a thatched roof, not iron or corrugated or tin roof. And you'll probably have a structure which is probably about, at best case, they're living in a place which is probably 10 by 10. And they'll typically have 6 or 7 family members living under that thatched roof.
Let me ask the question this way. What is the economic glue or the social glue that holds a village together? What is the reason for people in Africa to live in these villages that seem so barren, really?
Well, so two different questions. The economic glue is that there hardly is very little economic glue. The economic glue is the fact that this is their plot of land and they're farmers. And this is the only thing they have.
Each villagers or each family has a little plot of land that next to their house in the village.
That's correct.
That the way it works?
That's right. And typically the plot of land could be a hectare of land. And so that's the economic glue. The social glue is actually quite advanced. There's a strong culture within their community. These are not people while they lack all the things I just mentioned, and such as lacking things as access to safe water, they actually have a very strong culture and a tradition within their culture. And they're not deprived of that culture. They're just deprived of many of the scientific advancements in modern life.
Why then is it, if they've got a way of living that has worked for them, why is it important for there to be a change in the way that they live?
Yeah, that's a terrific question, because what we're trying to do is improve their livelihood in the sense of education, health care. Right now, on an annual basis, 1.5 million children in Africa die a year of malaria. Malaria is a disease that no one should even contract anymore, because there are preventative measures to take, whether it be sleeping under an insecticide-treated bed net or taking prophylactic medications. And if you do get malaria, there's actually ways to treat malaria. Yet 1.5 million people, usually typically under 5, die every year. So part of our program is the distribution of mosquito nets, so children could sleep under a net, and also providing for medications, frontline medications, if someone contracts malaria. So it's really trying to improve their mortality. We're not changing their culture. We're not trying to inject Western values. We're trying to just really bring modern science and technology to a village so they can have some economic prosperity and get out under than trying to survive on a dollar a day.
If I may add something to that.
Yeah,
part of the answer to that question, and I think the question can also be phrased in part, correct me if I'm wrong, how can people who survive in this culture and this way of life for so long suddenly be having these more acute problems? Because some of these problems have been around for a long time, but some of them become more acute as the world is modernized. For example, there are a lot more people now in Africa than there were ever before. So the increasing population density has, you know, people may have had more land per person to farm. That amount of land now available per family to farm is much less than it was before. In Africa, because they have traditionally had soils that are not necessarily full of nutrients, they would use one plot of land and then they'd rotate over several years, so that way land after you grow crops in a 1 year has a chance to re-nutrify. And now since there's so many people in many parts of Africa, that is no longer an option. So these things have changed. Some aspects of the way some of these people have been living were more appropriate in prior circumstances. This had nothing to do with culture. This has to do, with Mr. Pflug was saying, more with some of the technologies that we have access to that we take for granted, and that they could also use now in the new demographic circumstances.
And let me add one more point. I think this is also a somewhat relevant point, although we don't really advertise this type of thinking. But former Secretary of State Colin Powell, in remarks last year, said to really some of the world leaders, we can't even begin to really seriously think about winning the war on terror until we address the war on poverty. And I think that's really a really relevant point. It's not the point that drives us and our organization, but it is a relevant point as we think about the global world and a more secure world is really trying to address the needs of people living in poverty.
Let me ask you this. We need to take a break, but I had a law partner that every time I would go around to solicit funds for the good cause, he was great. He would ultimately make a contribution. But every time I would talk about the good cause and the good things that would be done, he would say, all right, well, DG, that's all well and good, but what's in it for me? That's a fair question. And so my question for you guys is this effort and the enthusiasm that the kids on the three campuses have for this project, is it generated by compassion and social concern, or is it generated by a notion of, I'm going to do this because in the long run, this is going to be good for me? And Nathan, you're out there raising money. what's the strong point of this? Nathan Sikar.
I think why it works is because it's a combination of both. I mean, there are really practical reasons why we should be concerned about the welfare of other people in the world. And I mean, like Mr. Pflug said, some of the events that have happened in the last 10 years have shown that we can't really isolate ourselves as a country anymore, and that the welfare of people in other parts of the world is really very much linked to our own. But I think that it's a part of our ethic as a culture here and in most of the world to be concerned about the welfare of others. And whether it's if you look at religion, whether it's Christianity or Buddhism or Islam, or whether you just look at our national culture, the idea that the welfare of others is related to the welfare, my own welfare, is very strong. And I think that we have the empathy to understand that it's not necessarily even right for us to really enjoy the affluence, our affluence, and all the great luxuries we have in our part of the world without thinking about the fact that other people can't even survive because they don't have the basic resources for food and medicine on a day-to-day basis. And to enjoy our situation without thinking about those other people is against our very moral fabric. So I think it's a combination of both practical and moral issues.
All right, well, we're going to take a break. That was Nathan Sikar, who is the leader on the Carolina campus for the Millennium Village Project. And we're
a leader, just so you know.
A leader. I hope I said a leader. Looked like there were a bunch. You were surrounded by a bunch of leaders.
Absolutely.
And we're joined by Jeff Pflug, who is the chief executive officer and executive director of the Millennium Promise Alliance. We'll talk some more with Jeff and with Nathan after this short break. Welcome Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Jeff Flug, who is the Chief Executive Officer and Executive Director of Millennium Promise Alliance. He was in Chapel Hill recently as a part of the Duke Carolina game to accept a check on behalf of the whole group of Millennium projects of $250,000 from a fraternity in Chapel Hill. He's joining us, and with him is one of the leaders of the Millennium Village project on the Carolina campus, which is also in partnership with Duke and Bennett College, Nathan Sikar. And welcome to all of you. Jeff, I want to talk just a little bit about your background, and because incredibly, you were successful in the very hot shot, you know, bond, all this complicated finance world that we read about in New York and the generation. What did Tom Wolfe call you guys? The
Masters of the Universe.
Masters of the Universe. And for some reason, you became acquainted with this concept of fighting poverty and the importance for everyone of tackling extreme poverty. So would you tell us just a little bit about your background and your passages and
sure.
What's happened to you?
Sure. It's actually, I hit a point in my life after close to 20 years in the financial sector on Wall Street, and I kind of reassessed where I was, what I had accomplished, and what I hadn't accomplished in my life. And I really felt something was missing. And really what was missing was trying to spend the bulk of my time doing something which I thought was more meaningful and more substantive with my time. And I had always cared about money. And when I learned about the 1 billion people living in poverty, it resonated with me. But really to take it a step further, when I heard there were actually solutions out there to some of these problems, then as a business person, I said, okay, well, I could get my head around that. If you're telling me it's about implementation then and mobilizing the resources to put the solutions in place, I could get pretty excited about that. So I could get pretty excited about knowing that right now there for $10, you could purchase a malaria insecticide treated bed net that will last for 5 years and protect 2 children, because you could fit 2 children under the net. And that will really reduce the chances of contracting malaria and making a huge dent on the 1.5 million children who die unnecessarily a year. As a businessman, I said, you know what? I want to focus my marginal time on thinking about that. And that was really what inspired me. Additionally, having 3 children, ages 15, 12, and 11, as a parent, I really want to also show them what, you know, as a role model, what decisions you can make in your lifetime. And so that was really the inspiration I needed. And so when I learned about the Millennium Village Project, it really was a natural fit, because they really needed some leadership in trying to implement the work. And so it was a good marriage between utilizing a lot of my managerial and financial skills coupled with some really strong academic thinking and developmental work that was already being in place. And so it's been 2 years for me now since I left the private sector and working in Millennium Promise, and it has far surpassed my expectations. I kind of joke with my family, I never thought taking a 95% pay cut I could actually have enjoyment on, but it really has been just a wonderful experience for me.
Well, I think it's always inspiring to see somebody who is takes the skills that could be applied to making a lot of money and early in life applies them towards doing something for other people. I want you, if you will, I know this is probably an impossible task, but you've practiced it. What is the model that you believe in, or the rough and ready aspects of the model that you believe in so that you're willing to commit your professional life to it, to fight poverty, and how is it distinguished from other efforts? And let me just say that there's a little bit of skepticism in my question, because you've talked about the $10 mosquito net, essentially, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, well, that's just another gift that I'm giving people. Mm-hmm. And I thought your model was community building and having people do things for themselves rather than being provided things. Yeah. And how's all this
It's really a terrific question. I have to say, I had the same skepticism when I first learned about this, too, because as a business person, I don't ascribe to handouts, but I do ascribe to investments. And as a business person, I understand the concept of a return on investment. And the way this program is, this is an investment. And so I'll give you a perfect example of this. In the first year, in many of the villages that we operate in, we actually provide a fertilizer subsidy. We provide seeds to the community on a subsidized basis. Now these communities are getting 3, 4, 5-fold yield increases. Take, for example...
All right, now, just let me interrupt you. I apologize.
Sure.
But, all right, so you invest in a... In cooperation and in discussions with the leaders of the community, you provide fertilizer. The immediate result, very short-term result, is increased yield. You say it's an investment. And do you really treat it as investment? You say, I want part of that. I want part of that increased yield.
So as part of our model, we say, okay, yes, we do. We say we want to take 10% of your crop, and we're going to take 10% of your crop and put it into a school feeding program. And we have about a 99% acceptance rate on that in Kenya when we first started it. So the farmers now readily give up 10% of their excess crop, and now it goes into a school feeding program. And now you're seeing school attendance. Because if you're a parent and you know your child get a good nutritional meal to school, you're going to send your child to school. So we're seeing our performance in the schools in Kenya go from 190th to 7th. In over a two-year time period. That's an investment. Now children are getting better educated. You asked a very good question. How is our model different than prior aid programs? We came across a lot of well-intended organizations who would go into a community and build a school, brand new school in a remote area. The problem is, unless you address their food security or lack of food, unless you address the fact that children will have to walk 4 miles or 5 miles round trip a day to access safe water, unless you address the fact they're going to be suffering from malaria, they're not going to be in school. And you have to attack this in an integrated, comprehensive solution. And that's what we're doing. And so that's the return. So right now, the return we're getting, that ROI, we're seeing school attendance and school scores go higher. We're seeing better access to water. We're seeing farmers for the first time able to diversify their crops, because prior to this, they only grew food so they could feed their families. Now they could take a portion of their land and start planting for cash crops because they have enough food security. And now they could think about getting some income growth going. That's an investment in their future.
You talk about the comprehensive strategy to deal with a whole big set of problems that are generally a part of extreme poverty. How do you do this without being a dictator, or without sort of sending out a directive to the village about what to do? How does all that develop under your model?
It is the first thing we do before we go into any village, and this could last between 3 and 6 months. We call mobilize the community. They have to understand what the expectations are. This is a new model of doing a new model. We are not there. We don't. The first question we always get asked: are we handing out cash to the villages? We say no. Are you giving cash, American dollars, to the government? We say no. And that's a very different model than what has been taking place for decades. And what we say to them is, we're going to work with you in partnership, but you're doing the work. And you're going to have to really lead this effort, but we're going to work as a partner with you in introducing new technologies, whether it be in science or agriculture or hydrology. And we're going to work with you and the government, the district governments, to introduce and really together build this model of success.
Can you give me a sort of typical example when you say, when we work with you? Who describe the partners, that is, describe the we, and then describe the village leaders, or who the players are in Africa or in the other country that you might be working in?
Certainly. So what you'll find typically in these villages, it goes back to your question about the social glue. They actually have more or less a pretty good governance structure. There's a village leader, and there's organization around these villages. Despite how poor they are, there's actually a structure around it. But we go in there, we actually want to make sure there's an agricultural committee, a education committee, comprised of the village leadership. And they work with our coordinated people, our health coordinator, our education coordinator. At the same time, we're working with the ministries of health, education, agriculture, really all together to come up and devise the plan for that village for agriculture.
And as the we, is that you?
That's Moni and Promise. That's Moni and Promise. It's the village leadership. It's the local government.
No,
and
but I
officials.
Mean on your side, on the side. Where who are the describe for me some of the people
sure.
who are the we's
on
site in Africa doing this stuff.
So
is it a black African or is it a white kid from
right.
Carolina or
I don't even
know. Who is it?
So the we is actually a few people in the we. In the we is Columbia University's. There's a field, and a department within the university called the Earth Institute. Dr. Jeffrey Sachs is the director of that.
We're going to talk about him in a minute. Yeah.
Okay.
But late after this next break.
Yeah. And so what Jeff has done is Jeff has access to some of the leading agronomists, hydrologists, malariologists, climatologists in the world, and they will go over to actually work with the local leadership there to teach them how to put a bore well in. And after the third bore well that goes into an area, they know how to do the fourth one. And after showing, and after the leading agronomist will show them how to plant differently, and usually literally showing how to put the seeds in the ground to optimize their yield, after one season, they know how to do it the second time. That's the we. So the we is some of it certainly is the local leadership. In all our local, Ammonium Promises local staff, they are all nationals. They may not be from the specific villages, but they're from the country. So the partnership is really between Moni and Promise, the Earth Institute scientist, and the local staff on the ground.
Well, we need to take a break. I'm visiting with Jeff Flug, who is the chief executive officer and executive director of Millennium Promise Alliance, operating out of New York. And we're joined by one of the Carolina students who's a leader on campus, Nathan Sikar, and the three of us will be right back after the short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Jeffrey Flug, who is the Chief Executive Officer and Executive Director of Millennium Promise Alliance. We're talking about the Millennium Village Projects, in particular about the efforts of students at Carolina, at Duke, and Bennett College to fight international poverty. And I'm learning a lot of lessons, Nathan, from you and from your buddy Jeff here, whom you call Mr. Flug. You've got great
you call
Southern
me Jeff.
Manners coming from Birmingham. But you guys are clearly influenced by the power of the ideas of another person and who visited down in Chapel Hill, I guess a little more than a year ago, and who's written a book called The End of Poverty, Jeffrey Sachs. And I guess we can't have this conversation and explore what's happening without understanding his contribution to this. And Jeff, what... You were moved by the ideas
yeah.
as a business person, moved by the ideas of an economics professor who seemed to have another idea about how to fight poverty. Can you take us through that experience and tell us about him?
Certainly. So Jeff, as you know, is a well-regarded macroeconomist, spent two decades at Harvard, now is the director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. But probably equally importantly, Jeff was asked by Secretary General Kofi Annan in the early 2000s to be a special envoy to the United Nations to help implement the Millennium Development Goals. So after all the countries in the world—
I guess I
yes.
do not want to interrupt you, but
sure.
Millennium Development Goals is a new concept from most of us.
So what, actually, Nathan, why don't you talk about the Millennium Development Goals? We did a nice job this morning on that.
Yeah, Nathan— Sekar, a Carolina student, can do that pretty well.
Sure. Well, so essentially, in the year 2000, all the nations of the United Nations decided that they had to do something about extreme poverty and that it was an unacceptable problem. But they realized they needed time-bound and measurable targets to actually make an impact. They can't just kind of say, oh, we don't like extreme poverty and leave it at that. So for that purpose, they established the Millennium Development Goals.
And these are the goals that you're talking about.
Yes.
That,
8 goals.
Jeffrey Sachs, he was recruited by Kofi Annan to come up with a pragmatic
plan.
Okay.
That's right. And so these are the 8 goals. And it was really, so what followed, as Nathan said, was how do you come up with a plan to implement it? It's great you have these goals. What are you going to do about them? How do you actually get it done? And that's really the work that followed took about 2.5 years to come up. Really, and the work that was followed included a whole world of experts in developmental work, in economy, in agriculture, to come up with a plan. And this was the plan that came out. It was the Millennium Village Project and how you could go and deliver certain interventions to communities, work with the community so it's community-led. Here's how much it's going to cost to do this on a per capita basis and to really address the Millennium Development Goals. It's critical work. And as was stated before, they're time bound and time is running out because a lot of these goals that was set right around the millennium had a 2015 end date. We're halfway through right now. Africa is still lagging behind other parts of the world who are living in extreme poverty. So it's why there's such a strong sense of urgency right now by the whole world to get behind really the achieving the MDGs.
Jeff, what was it about those ideas? What was the hook that grabbed you? Do you remember what it was when you read something or saw something?
Yeah, practical. This wasn't a think tank. Probably a couple points. One, I personally like the fact that there wasn't money going to national governments. It wasn't just send your check in. I like the fact that it wasn't money being, we weren't handing out. This was a model that we're going to teach a man to fish rather than give the man a fish. And that to me was really the hook that got me motivated to be part of that.
So those ideas that you said this can work.
It was, yes.
And it has I don't want to call it a philosophical, but an economic idea that is not related to dependency funding, but is related to entrepreneurial funding in some respect, which grabbed you as a business person.
Very much so.
Well, all right, now you've been working at it for a while. Now, you're an upbeat guy and you're a salesman. I mean, you've been selling bonds, all this, so you're not, I mean, your strong suit is probably not dealing with the downside of things, but in this kind of business, there've got to be matters that come up all the time that you didn't anticipate that you got to deal with and you got to be upbeat about dealing with them, but they're difficult problems. What are the kinds of things that are confronting you that maybe, I don't want to say surprise, but are ones which, you know, aren't a part of the model that you got to deal with?
Certainly. And let me just state, if this was the easy problem, it would have been solved by now. The fact that 1.1 billion people live in extreme poverty, if there's no silver bullet answer. But to give you an example just of the complexities around this work, take, for instance, the most recent Kenyan elections. The country Kenya just had its presidential elections on December 27th. Kenya, which really has seen prior to the elections almost as a crown jewel in East Africa, a country which is a democratically elected government, multi-tribal, good relations, an economy that's growing at 6%, really was seen as the beacon for East Africa. It has absolutely devolved right now, post the elections, into chaos, into just a huge amount of tragic killing, in destruction, in looting. And we're trying to operate now in an environment where there's safety.
So you have your doctrine and your model, but you got something that was totally unplanned for, and you're in the middle of trying to develop the right kind of response, and you'll probably be changing your minds as you go.
Changing our minds. I mean, the most critical issue right now is the planting season in Kenya, where we are, is this month. Meaning, if we don't get the seed and fertilizer in the ground, there's going to be untold levels of famine. And right now, there are the logistic issues because the roads going in and out of that city aren't inaccessible. And so issues like that, issues of how you ship things into a port and get them into your villages when the ports are closed, all these things come up. And we have similar, not the same type of issues, but similar challenges in other countries where logistics issues come up. And it's challenging. It's just not easy work. But if the alternative is, just don't try, That's unacceptable.
Yeah. Well, we do need to take a break. I don't want to interrupt that thought. It's very moving, your approach to it. We're talking about the Millennium Village projects, and we're privileged to have Jeff Pflug, who's the executive in charge of all this in New York, and also Nathan Sikar, who is a leader on the Carolina campus for their Millennium Village project. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Jeff Pflug, who's come down from New York to celebrate the successful Millennium Village Promise projects on the Carolina, Duke, and Bennett College campuses. Jeff, thanks for giving us some background, and we understand better why the kids or why the young people are so excited. Tell us a little bit more about what's going on at Chapel Hill, at Duke, and Bennett that got you excited enough to come down here rather than going to Africa to help solve some of those Kenyan problems? Yeah.
Well, put simply, what's happening here in this community is nothing short of pure leadership on a global level. These are college university students who have decided to take a global lead role in becoming the first university, and really tri-party universities, to sponsor Millennium Village, to express their leadership in caring about extreme poverty, because they want to eradicate the issue. And as 18, 19, 20-year-olds, we're completely just agape, if it's the right word, just on their wisdom and compassion and passion and leadership. And so they're setting a real incredible example for the rest of the country, and it's happening right here in your community. That's how we came on down.
Did Nathan have anything to do with this?
Very much so. Nathan, why don't you maybe describe your efforts?
This is Nathan Sikar, who is one of the – is it co-coordinator, Nathan?
Yes, sir.
Tell us a little bit from your perspective what the kids have done and why they're so excited about it.
Sure. Well, we the way this started at UNC and then at Duke and at Bennett is that we realized that our universities and our colleges have these amazing resources in various ways. We have great academic resources. We have experts in fields that are very relevant to extreme poverty. And we have great donors and alumni who have a lot of the financial resources necessary to help make inroads against the fight against poverty. And we really thought that our universities have all this knowledge and all these resources, and instead of just being institutions of learning, that we would really like our schools to be catalysts for global change. We want our schools to be in the midst of the effort to really make extreme poverty history. So that's why when we looked around for models and for projects to support, and we had a video conference with Dr. Jeffrey Sachs, who we mentioned earlier, and we did some research. We found out that there are some weak points in MVP and really any other development model, but we saw that this is the best one available, and this is the one that we'd like to work with. And we thought that if we can get UNC and Duke and Bennett in on this effort, we can get some of the brightest minds in various fields, public health, environmental sustainability, agriculture, in on this project and help create this global network where professors from all over the country and are contributing to coming up with solutions for the world's greatest poverties and problems.
Well, now, are we really doing that, or are we just raising money on the Carolina campus?
We're doing both. Let me give you a couple of examples on how we've started building this network. Last year, when Jeff Pflug and Jeff Sachs came to visit UNC Chapel Hill, we had found this anthropologist who had created a peanut shelling machine. And what this machine does is it increases the rate at which an African farmer can shell peanuts 40 to 100 times. There's a hand-powered one that increases 40 times, and there's a pedal-powered one. So African women, they're spending day in, day out shelling peanuts. We're spending 1/40th of the time shelling peanuts, and then could take care of their kids, can go get some water for it to cook and to clean. And it really is a big step in development. And we introduced Jeffrey Sachs to Jacques Brandes, a gentleman who had helped invent the machine. And now some of those penis shelling machines are being tried out in a village in Kenya. UNC has one of the best water research institutions in the country. And we have now connected UNC's water researchers with some folks at Columbia's Earth Institute that are helping come up with scientific interventions for the communities in Africa. And so now they're using some of the water technology developed at Carolina, and they're experimenting with them to help get clean water at point of use and point of source water technologies to these communities in the Millennium Villages. And we figure, you know, the more institutions we get on, the more different types of expertise we incorporate into this network, the more of this really kind of state-of-the-art and really advanced thinking we can apply to the problem of extreme poverty.
Well listen, Jeff Luke and Nathan Sikar, I want to thank you for coming and sharing your enthusiasm and the excitement about this project. And now I understand just a little bit better what was behind that $250,000 check that was passed at halftime at the Duke-Carolina basketball game. Thanks to both of you.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to all y'all for listening. I'll be back same time tomorrow.